Next case for today is appeal number 10-3198, United States against Mr. Foster. Mr. Schindler, good morning.
Good morning.
I thought we saw each other last week. So.
For the record, Your Honor, Ralph Schindler on behalf of Napoleon Foster. Your Honor, I'd like to rest on the brief for the majority of my argument, but I'd like to bring to the Court's attention two issues that are set forth in the brief. But and the first issue I'd like to talk about is the Rule 24 issue. And before I came over this morning, I went on the district court's website and pulled up the standing order for final pretrial order regarding selection of jurors and jury instructions before the same court and the district court in which this case was tried. And on page 3 of the standing order, again, the same procedure is outlined, and basically the judge says, the jury is selected by eliminating the names of all persons who have been excluded for cause or on the party's exercise of peremptory challenges and selecting the jury from the computerized random list provided to the court. The first 8 names for most civil juries on that random list will be selected as the jury. Thus, every member of the veneer panel has an equal chance of being selected as a juror. Now, that's this morning's standing order, and it was the procedure used in this case, and we submit that that violates Rule 24, and that basically, as set forth in our brief on page 22, in a criminal trial, the Rule 24 contemplates selection of alternates, quote, either by the jury box system or by a struck jury method in which defendants know the sequence in which members of the pool will be seated. So it's important, I think, if you're going to have some value to your peremptory challenges, that you know the sequence in which the jurors are going to enter the box. And this randomized method, whereby you use all your strikes and then they get scrambled up and put into the computer, and then out they come, and the first 12 are the jurors, and the last two are the next two are the alternates, denigrates the value of your peremptory challenges. I know most of you have trial court experience. I know I've tried several cases, and in my experience, you want to use your peremptories against the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or whatever the order is that you know those jurors are coming to the box.
In this case, what actually happened? Did they go through all this process before they seated anybody?
They alphabetize everybody, and you don't know the order in which. And it's confusing to me, and I read the transcript of the jury selection 2 or 3 times, but as you read the jury selection, it looks like they go alphabetically. You don't know the sequence. You have no idea what the sequence is.
Well, I guess, let's just say there are 40 in the veneer, and then
you use all your for causes. The for causes get
removed.
It could
be somebody who ends up number 40.
Right. Well, those guys are gone. So
okay,
then you've got, let's say you've got
preemptory.
You got 35 left, okay, and then you've got 10 peremptories, okay? So then you take out the peremptories, and whoever is left after that, that number gets scrambled, and the first 12 that come out of the computer are the jury box, and the next two are the alternates, and the rest of them don't get used.
Okay, so it dilutes the peremptory.
Right.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Schindler, oh, go ahead.
Sorry.
Yep. Let's assume you're right that the method here was inconsistent with Rule 24. Could you address, it seems to me, your two major obstacles there? One is waiver, since defense counsel did not object to this, nor indicate that he did not understand what was going on. And second, the question that was addressed, I think, at some length in Patterson along with other cases, namely whether there's any real harm as long as you still have an impartial jury, so that we would not treat this as reversible error.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, as I set forth in the brief on page 22, According to the Delgado case, a Sixth Circuit case, 2003, compliance with the rule is not a matter entrusted to the sound discretion of the trial court.
Right.
So,
but you can still waive it, right?
I guess that's a question.
Why? I mean, why not? Let's assume everybody in the courtroom is happier and agrees with Judge Gettleman that this is that the net result is a more fair selection process. Why should we step in?
Well, I think one thing I would suggest is as part of your supervisory function that Judge Gettleman's the only one, in, as far as I know, in the Northern District of Illinois that uses this method. And it does, I would say, impair the right to a fair and impartial jury.
Then object, right? And that's the solution.
I know the government has argued that there was a waiver, and I know that this court's prior opinion in Patterson and has said that there is a waiver. So I guess what I'm asking is the court, as part of its supervisory function, to say, Judge, don't do this anymore, basically, is what I'm. And the way you say that is to reverse and give a new trial.
What are you worried about? You figure you get off on the wrong foot with the judge if you object to that?
Yes.
Is an intimidation
factor? I'm sure that's part of the problem.
I mean, most comes in there and says, you know.
Well, when the judge says, this is the way we do it in my court. Okay. Are you going to stand there and say, objection, Your Honor? Okay. This is the way we do it. You look at a standing order.
If a judge says, in my court, hearsay is just fine, we certainly expect you to have the spine to object, right?
I didn't try the case, but I would agree, Your Honor. I would, for the record, object, I guess. But that's not the situation, and perhaps this will come back before the court on a 2255. I don't know. But
you have to show some serious prejudice to get any relief there.
Well, I think in terms of prejudice, and you raised that issue in terms of the prejudice, I mean, the two alternates, the two people that wound up being alternates, one was a black lady and one was a Latina, and those two wound up being removed, and the 39th juror was, in fact, a guy who applied for FBI, and he wound up being the foreman. So I guess to some extent you can argue, well, based on those backgrounds, he would have stricken those people had the sequence. He would have certainly stricken the 39th guy. Well, he probably would not have stricken the 39th guy because he never would have gotten to him and used up his peremptories before that. So had he known the sequence in which these people were going to come into the box, I think that he would have used them more intelligently, let's put it that way.
Is there any indication of that the jury that was selected was anything other than impartial?
There's nothing in the record that indicates bias, prejudice, or anything other than that. So I can't really point to that. But again, Your Honor, I think every case that comes before this court is going to have this same issue probably. Maybe there'd be a better record, but we would think it's something that perhaps, and apparently the trial court thinks that in the Patterson case, this court affirmed his methodology of using this method, and I would request that you make it clear that perhaps that's not the case. Now, the second issue I'd like to address is the 404B issue, and that is this whole introduction of evidence of a check-cashing scheme that supposedly was between Asia Hill, who was one of the bank robbers, and Mr. Foster. There was a pretrial motion filed in which the government gave notice of its intent to introduce evidence of this check-cashing scheme under 404B. And the trial court ruled, before this court ruled in Gorman, that it would be admissible as inextricably intertwined. In other words, it set the background information in terms of how these two individuals met. But the evidence, I think, if you do a 403 analysis in terms of its prejudicial impact, was devastating because she was able to go on probably for 2 hours in the transcript about how she went into, she got her fake ID from Mr. Foster, allegedly. She went into the bank, cashed this check. She got 10% of the proceeds. He got the rest. and there were two or three other girls working for him at the same time, and very, I think, prejudicial and questionable, and it was admitted as inextricably intertwined.
Does that show any propensity to rob a bank?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's...
Why is it relevant to 404 or anything else?
That would be my argument, Your Honor. I don't see why it came in. And to compound things, not only was her testimony allowed as to that, but they also brought in Frank Nusko, who was
I know, but the purpose of 404 is to keep out evidence of propensity. So I don't see where we got any of that here. So maybe we can't talk about inextricably whatever at this point.
But
it seems to me that this business of relevancy to other events, I don't know how we're going to keep that out of our heads. I don't really understand the
point
of the whole exercise. But I don't know why 404 is a way to go with these things, because I don't think there's much indication that this has got much to do with showing this people's character, propensity, or whatever.
Well, the government in this brief argues that there were other grounds of admissibility to prove intent, identity, opportunity, preparation, plan, or motive. But again, I don't think any of those that this check cashing scheme really doesn't prove any of those things. I mean, Asia Hill was pretty adamant that she knew this guy, and she even testified she had had sex with the guy. So I think his identity was pretty clear to her. So,
well, it also shows sort of a mutual trust in crime. He was operating, she wasn't getting enough money, but nevertheless, they had this scheme going. So now they're going to rob a bank. This is already somebody however you want to describe the relationship, but there's some sort of a mutual trust in crime. I don't know whether that comes into one of those.
But I think that's more propensity. We got in this other crime over here, and therefore we want to do the next one.
I think it's more of propensity means some individual motivation. There's some kind of a relationship here, I think, it establishes.
Well, I think she could have just said, I knew him from, 2006, some business engagement back in 2006.
No, it wasn't a business engagement. They were partners in crime. And did something, and so they went and did something more difficult, but nevertheless.
Well, but again, I think under that analysis, you have to look at the prejudicial impact of that type of testimony compared to its probative value. And in this case, I think the prejudicial impact is very high, and it should have been excluded based on that.
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Schindler? I frankly have your argument resonates that this long discussion bringing in the victim of the check cashing scheme for a reason that I hope the government will explain to me. I understand that all the details may have been far more than might have been necessary, but it does seem to me, as Judge Mannion's question suggests, there's a legitimate purpose in saying. In allowing Hill to testify about the origin and nature of their relationship. And the best objection to that is not to exclude all mention of it, but to basically confine it sharply. I didn't see that kind of objection raised. The judge had already said at least some of this is coming in. I don't know how specific or general that ruling was. But I didn't see an objection to the effect, in essence, look, we're way beyond any legitimate purpose here.
Your Honor, I would concede that there is no objection when Frank Nusko took the stand. But I think the explanation of that is that the judge had ruled in his pretrial order that evidence of this whole check cashing scheme and all the related parts of it, I think, were admissible under 404B. And having ruled that direction, I don't think...
I thought he never did a 404B analysis. It was all just inextricably intertwined.
That was the analysis, but there was a pretrial ruling that allowed this evidence to come in. And so I think it was based on that that the objection would be preserved. That would be our contention. I see my time is up.
We'll give you a little extra time for rebuttal. So thank you very much, Mr. Schindler. For the government, Ms. Kasteneck. morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Andriana Kostanek on behalf of the United States. I'm going to start with the defendant's argument regarding the selection of jurors in this case. His argument has two components, that the peremptory strikes on alternates were not reserved until they were impaneled, and then he focuses in his reply brief as well as his argument on the argument that the jurors were shuffled before they were actually selected. I'll start with the last one because that's where the focus is here. And I'm going to correct first a factual error that he makes. You asked what the actual procedure was that happened here. And what happened is that the judge had the parties exercise all of their for-cause and peremptory strikes on the entire pool, and then it took the remaining pool members and it had it shuffled that list using a computerized scramble system, and from that list it seated the jurors sequentially. Now, the factual error is that the defendant seems to suggest now that the number of peremptory strikes he received was not proportional to the total pool, and that's incorrect. If you look at the government's appendix, pages 2 and 3, the district court explains that the number of peremptory strikes that the each side will get will be in proportion to the 10 and the 6. There's no allegation that there weren't sufficient peremptory strikes provided to either party. Extras in proportion to the 10 and the 6 to be in proportion to the total number of jurors in the pool.
What is it, the 10%? I don't know how the total pool was. How many were out
there? I think
there?
That they, once they exercised their strikes, there were 38 left. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they were left with for the scrambled list. Now, this is significant because the defendant in his reply brief relies on Underwood. And in Patterson, this court overturned Underwood. It is no longer good law. In Patterson, this court explained that the Supreme Court's opinion in Martinez-Salazar draws into question, makes no longer good law, Underwood's holding that the failure to sequentially seat jurors absent a scrambled list is reversible error. And in Patterson, this exact same procedure was used. The strikes were exercised on the pool, and then the juror pool was shuffled, and then they took the first 14, as the 12 as the jurors and 2 as alternates. And this court held that there is no right to a strategic use of peremptory challenges, that the purpose of Rule 24 is to preserve a constitutional right to a fair jury, and thus the defendant does not have a right to know the order in which the jurors will be seated, and allows for a scrambled list. With respect to...
Do you think that's the way Rule 24 reads?
Yes, and just to address, because the defendant does cite Rule 24C, which says alternates will be seated sequentially and separately. They certainly were seated separately here. And with respect to sequentially,
Without separate peremptory challenges. I don't see how you reconcile that procedure with Rule 24.
Oh, right. And that's a separate issue from what I was just discussing. And on that issue, the government does admit error, that does violate Rule 24. The Rule 24C says that the alternate jurors, that there must be separate peremptory challenges reserved and exercised when they're in panel. That did not happen here. But at the same time, the district court judge recognized that was a departure from Rule 24 and asked the parties to expressly consent to that procedure. And that was done twice, both in the pretrial hearing. He laid out the procedure that was going to happen, and it's a lengthy discussion. In the reply brief, the defendant gives short thrift to what actually happened. If you look at the text of the explanation, the whole procedure is laid out, and the parties agreed. And it happened again prior to the selection of the jury, and the parties again agreed. And so there's, even though there was error with regards to the reservation of those strikes, that error was agreed upon by the parties, and in any event is harmless. With respect to the defendant's argument with sending a signal to this district court judge and that he didn't have an opportunity to object, I think a couple of things are of note. If you look at the exchange between the parties and the district court, there certainly was an opportunity to object. The district court judge was not telling the parties, this is how we're doing it, you can't object to this. He asked the parties whether it was agreeable to them. And his practice is that if it's not agreeable to the parties, that is not the way that the procedure will be done. And the parties in this case said that it was agreeable to them, and so they proceeded with a streamlined procedure.
Why is the government continuing to agree to this if you are repeatedly having to defend it on appeal and risking convictions?
Well, as a factual matter, the government does not proceed with the procedure if there is an objection by the defense. The government engages in a streamlined procedure if it's agreed upon by the parties. The office is well aware of the contours of Rule 24 and aware, as this district court judge was, that in order to proceed with this type of procedure, that both parties must be in agreement. So in this case, they were, and they proceeded as such. If there's an objection from the defense, that is not how Rule 24 and the jury selection would be approached.
Was this process generally okay with the government?
If there's no objection from the defense...
No, does the government ever object to that procedure?
I think that the government generally is okay with that procedure if there's no objection from the defense.
But I haven't done this for a long time, and I know I really want to hear what Judge Hamilton says, but it seems to me that when you get your first panel in, that's when the preemptories are worth something. If they're all sitting out there and you don't know whether they're going to be there or not, that's sort of a roll of the dice.
Right, but at the same time, Your Honor, that there were a proportional number of peremptory strikes allowed here. So
in proportion to what?
In proportion to the 10 and the 6.
Okay, so 10 and 6 means they get 10, the government gets 6?
Yes, that's
okay,
correct.
But if you got them in the panel, they may get fewer.
That's not correct.
Well, what's
so
the proportion then?
It means that as the jury pool gets larger, that the government and the defense are given additional peremptory strikes in proportion to the 10 and the 6.
Yeah, okay.
So that the defense, there's no argument, and it's not supported by the record, that they could not have gotten rid of the individuals they complain about. For example, in his reply brief, he cites this individual who applied to the FBI. He had sufficient peremptory strikes to get rid of that individual,
well, yeah,
and he chose not to do so.
I know, but if I would rather have 5 preemptories than 10 if I know who's in the pan, as
okay.
opposed to who's sitting out there and roll the dice. That's just my opinion, and it may be wrong.
I understand your point, but that also is exactly what was rejected in Patterson, because what Underwood held was exactly what you just said, that the failure to know who's going to be in the jury box is reversible error, that you have to know the sequence. And what the court held in Patterson after the Supreme Court issued Martinez-Salazar is that there is no such right to that, that peremptory strikes are not meant to be strategic, even though that might be what the defense wants, but there's no constitutional right to a strategic use of peremptory challenges.
Is there a constitutional right to a peremptory strike?
No, there's not. And as a result, that goes into our harmless error argument, that there's no right to a peremptory challenge. The presumption is that the deprivation of a peremptory challenge does not affect a defendant's constitutional rights. I'll address Rule 404B quickly. The trial in this case happened prior to this court's decision in Gorman, so it was during a time when the inextricably intertwined and 404B doctrines overlapped. There was a lot of confusion there, and that's evident in this court's opinion, or in the district court's opinion, both its pretrial ruling as well as its ruling on defendant's post-trial motions, that he uses key phrases from both doctrines. He admits it under the inextricably intertwined doctrine, but his rationale is a 404B one. He says that it explains the origin of the party's relationship and the evolution of that relationship, as well as how the criminal scheme came about. Those are quintessential 404B categories. It's preparation, planning, opportunity. In addition, that evidence went to the defendant's identity, which was a key issue at trial. The defendant argued at trial that there was a third man involved, and it wasn't him. And this evidence established that Asia Hill was competent to identify the defendant as the third person. She knew him from a prior criminal enterprise. And
why the victim of the check cashing scheme?
Well, the victim's testimony corroborated that of Asia Hill, which goes to the third prong of the 404B requirement, which is that the evidence be sufficient to establish that this criminal scheme happened.
Elimination of inextricably whatever is just going to lead to stretching these categories under 404B. I think that's where we're going with this whole thing, which I'm not sure that's a step forward.
That might be true. I don't think it's true in this case. I think
I think this was let in because it happened immediately before the bank robbery, and somebody thought it was relevant. And I guess it reflected some, you can make a case that it reflected somewhere on the propensity of these people to rob a bank, but that's a stretch in my book.
Do we have a 403 analysis by the district judge here?
There's not an extensive analysis on that, but it is worth noting that there was a limiting instruction given, and the defense mischaracterizes that instruction in his reply brief.
But if it's a limiting instruction, when the judge himself hasn't done a 404B, isn't admitting it on 404B, then how does that help?
Well, as a matter of law, this court's case law says that if there's a limiting instruction given, the presumption is that there's no prejudice because the jury is assumed to understand that it's only going to the key components of 404B, in this case, opportunity, identity, preparation, planning.
I'm struggling, though, if the district judge has not admitted it on a 404B. Theory.
Well, two points to that. The first is that the key phrases of the district court's opinion indicates that he understood that it was 404B evidence. It just was at a time period when that was kind of mixed up with inextricably intertwined. With respect to the 403 question, even though it wasn't an analysis that the district court engaged in any great detail, the record does support that the probative value of this evidence in terms of going to the categories laid out by 404B outweighed its prejudicial effect, which is demonstrated by the limiting instruction. But even if the court didn't engage in that analysis, you can affirm on that basis from the record of the trial. Returning just quickly to your question about Frank Nusko, as you noted in your questions to the defendant, that was not an objection at trial, that it went beyond the scope of 404B. And this isn't a case where the tail is wagging the dog. There was plenty of evidence at trial. It wasn't Frank Nusko's testimony was one of many, many witnesses in the course of a 1.5-week trial. This was not a forefront of this trial, and thus the evidence. The defendant raises this issue in the context of a constitutional inquiry.
Was this objected to under 404B?
It was. There was briefing prior to trial on this issue, and they did object on grounds of both under the inextricably intertwined and 404B grounds. But even if there is error, even if this is on the margins of being admitted under 404B, he raises it in a constitutional context, the arguing that the cumulative errors deprived him of a fair trial, and taking this as a whole, the error was not sufficient to deprive him of a fair trial. There was plenty of evidence in this case, overwhelming evidence to convict.
In 1.5 weeks of trial, about how much time was spent on this check cashing scheme?
Well, there were two witnesses, Asia Hill, and
she had a lot of other things to say.
She testified about the whole scheme, so the entire robbery from start to finish. I think that there's identified in the brief, I don't know it off the top of my head, but there's probably about 20 pages of her testimony, or give or take, where she testifies about this. So it's a pretty small amount compared to her entire testimony. If there are no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
I had one. Anderson's statements to Williams.
Right.
The government offered those as co-conspirator statements 6 months after the robbery?
Well, this wasn't fleshed out very well at trial because it wasn't the subject of an objection, and that's exactly why the court should review this for plain.
It was part of your Santiago proffer.
It's not addressed in any detail in the Santiago proffer, and it wasn't objected to at trial, so the government wasn't required to give any full explanation of this. But it was presented at trial and in the closing arguments as a prior consistent statement. If you look at the government's closing arguments, the prosecutor talks about it in the context of corroborating Charles Anderson's testimony at trial regarding the defendant's involvement and being consistent with that testimony, and it squarely falls within that category.
It was consistent with whether his testimony was consistent with his telephone conversation?
It wasn't a telephone conversation. They were riding around in a car. It was a recorded conversation with Randy Williams.
Okay.
But yes, that conversation with Randy Williams was consistent with Charles Anderson's testimony at trial, and that those tapes were admitted after the motive that he was alleged to have been fabricating his testimony, which was raised both in the defendant's opening statement as well as in the cross-examination
sort
of Asia Hill.
A rebuttal type of thing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Kostanek. Mr. Schindler, rebuttal? Take two.
Just to clarify, I think The transcripts of the jury selection are set in the government's brief, I believe, in the appendix. And in response to Judge Mannion's question, I think what happened here, we start with 40 in the panel, and then five were excused for cause. That left 35. The judge says, well, I need 12 and 2, so that's 14. So that left 21, and I've got right now 10 and 6 in terms of 10 for the defendant peremptories and 6 for the government. So if I take the 16 from the 21, that leaves me 5 more. So he gave the defendant 3 more peremptory challenges and the government 2. So I think what happened was the defendant wound
the
up with
remaining panel as opposed to those seated.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the government wound up with 8 peremptories and the defendant wound up with 13 against 35 people on the. But I agree with you, Your Honor. I'd rather know. Yeah. I'd rather have 5 that I could, you know who I'm striking than 13 not knowing who's who. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Schindler.
Right.
Case is taken under advisement.